Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a not-for-profit 30-minute weekly audio podcast primarily for and by amateur astronomers in the UK. Available only online, AT UK is a virtual meeting point for the amateur astronomy community. Each episode is an MP3 file which can be downloaded automatically with a free subscription via one of the many podcast readers. I use iTunes. My name is Gurbir Singh and I host AT UK. I am not a scientist, nor am I an astronomer. Topics of discussion have no fixed boundaries other than their relevance to amateur astronomy. Each week's episode consists of pre-recorded conversations with individuals discussing their roles, lives and achievements of amateur astronomers and their hobby. More about AT UK at www.astrotalkuk.org. If you have a topic for discussion, drop me a note on info@astrotalkuk.org. AstroTalk UK, amateur astronomy, expert opinion. Episode 9, Sunday, March the 30th, 2008. The 1850s Manchester was a little bit like the 1990s San Francisco, or perhaps the Shanghai of today. Centre of all the action, place where combination of innovation, talent and personal drive could make you lots of money very quickly. During the 19th century Manchester, one individual combined all of the above and an interest in making telescopes. Kevin Kilburn, a former president of Manchester AS and the current secretary for the Society of History of Astronomy. Before talking about Naismith, I asked Kevin to talk about himself.
I've been interested in astronomy for well over 50 years, but my daytime job started actually in this building here at MMU when I did polymer chemistry back in the 1970s.
That's the Manchester Metropolitan University.
That's correct, yes. Because I've had 40 years in the plastics industry as technical manager, sales manager, and latterly as purchasing manager. So that's what I do from 9 till 5.
And I know in the astronomy arena, you do a lot of writing as well as observing and astrophotography. It's quite a... You don't have a specialism as such in astronomy itself.
Well, in my teens, having built a 6-inch telescope and latterly going up to 12-inch homemade reflectors, I've always had a strong interest in observing the moon. But about 15 years ago, an eye accident put paid to visual observing. So latterly, I've turned to writing about astronomy. I have taught astronomy in night school for about 25 years. Latterly, the history of astronomy has fascinated me when I started to research the history of Manchester Astronomical Society.
Yes, Manchester, of course, is one of the older amateur astronomical societies.
It's almost as old as Liverpool Astronomical Society. They were founded in 1881 and more or less went bankrupt in 1890, by which time the British Astronomical Association took over as a national amateur society for astronomers. But there was a need for astronomy in the Northwest, and Manchester were invited to form what was then, in 1892, the Northwest branch of the British Astronomical Association. And we became independent as Manchester Astronomical Society in 1903.
James Naismith, he's not a Mancunian, but he's associated with Manchester.
The thing that interests me about James Naismith is part of the reason that I became a member of the Society of the History of Astronomy. A lot is known about Naismith, but it tends to be written by astronomers for astronomers. Mm-hmm. And it's only when you look at the work that local historians have done on Naismith the engineer that you realise that James Naismith's autobiography, that was edited by Smiles back in the 1880s, only tells us what he wants us to tell. There's a lot that we still don't know about Naismith from the point of view of amateur astronomers. Right. And it's the correction of that history that interests me. And that's why I did some research on him about 2 years ago.
What was Naismith's profession?
Okay, James Naismith, from a very early age, he was born in Edinburgh in 1810. He was fascinated with mechanical things and steam engines. And he built his own along with his brother, George. They became associated with Henry Maudslay, the London engineer, in the 1830s, early 30s. And at about that time, they were trying to establish their own business, initially in Glasgow, in Edinburgh, but then they moved to Manchester in 1834 and set up a business in Dale Street.
That's in the centre of Manchester.
Indeed, not far from Piccadilly Station.
So James Naismith was an engineer?
Naismith was an engineer. He came to Manchester shortly after the start of the Industrial Revolution in 1830s. Set up in business with George, although if you read Naismith's autobiography, you get the impression that it was he alone that set up the business in Manchester. Right from the outset, he was actually an equal partner with his brother George, and they set up in Dale Street near Piccadilly Station in 1834.
And he made his money through the steam hammer?
Well, that came later. In 1836, they moved to a bespoke factory site in Patricroft, near Eccles, on the banks of the Bridgewater Canal, where they had access to transport by rail, near Patricroft Station, by canal. He had a road by the side of the factory, even had his own pub on the site, on the other side. And he made himself a fortune by the time that he retired in 1856.
So he's at the right place, Manchester, the right time, the outset of the Industrial Revolution, and he's quite a practical guy. So what's the connection with astronomy?
Well, in 1840 or thereabouts, Naismith invented the steam hammer, and that really made him a fortune. By this time, he was living on the bank of the Bridgewater Canal, in a house that he called Fireside. It's, for those who know that area, it's about 200 metres north of Patricroft Bridge, on the inside of the bend of the canal. And there he set up a very, very big telescope. He had made telescopes before he moved down from Edinburgh. We have records of him making small reflecting telescopes. But round about the 1840s, he built one of the biggest in the country. That was a 20-inch reflector, a very novel design.
Are there any records of what he observed?
Naismith was particularly interested in the planets Saturn, Jupiter, but especially the Moon. And his telescope, because it was an unusual design, it was an alt-azimuth-mounted reflecting telescope, sort of a Cassegrain instrument, but with an extra reflecting surface, it was no good for deep sky observing. It lost too much light by reflection. So he was interested in observing bright objects, particularly the Moon, and for that, a 20-inch telescope that could be operated by one man was absolutely perfect for what he wanted.
And do any of his observations survive?
In 1874, he wrote a book with Carpenter about the Moon, which is still a classic for that time.
Was he in a position to make use of the science of photography and his telescope together?
He didn't do any photography as far as we are aware. But he did make a 13-inch telescope for Warren de la Rue, and he actually was one of the pioneers of lunar photography.
So he's got a very large telescope, looking at the Moon and other bright objects. Did he go beyond that? Did he build any other telescopes?
Well, it's recorded that round about 1849, he wrote to a friend of his in Scotland, suggesting that he might in fact make a 60-inch diameter telescope. Now, at the time, that would have been the second largest telescope in the world, second only to the Earl of Ross's Leviathan of Parsonstown, which was a 72-inch monster. Unlike the Leviathan of Parsonstown, that needed an army of operators to point it for the observer, Naismith's design of reflecting telescopes, mounted on a trunnion, could be operated by one man. And his argument was that he could get far more use out of a telescope like that, even though it lost a lot of light, rather than have to employ workmen to actually point the thing.
He was still planning to build this very large telescope by himself, including the mirror?
Well, he had the facilities at the Bridgewater Foundry to build an instrument as big as a 60-inch reflector. It would have had a tube length of about 35 feet, so it was quite a monster. It would have weighed many, many tons. But obviously, the problem, as now, is that the Manchester weather was never particularly conducive to observing with such a large instrument. And it's recorded that, in fact, that the 20-inch telescope, after he retired in 1856, wasn't used that often because of tube currents. By that time, he was interested in solar observing. He was the first to observe the solar granulation. But to do that from his home in Kent, he was actually employing a 6-inch reflecting telescope, refracting telescope.
Although he never built the 60-inch telescope, quite an achievement to build and design a 20-inch telescope. Did his work have an impact on the availability of larger aperture telescopes generally?
Well, we're not sure. His friend was William Lassell in Liverpool, who had also had constructed for him very large aperture reflecting telescopes for observing the planets. In fact, James Naismith built a mirror grinding engine for Lassell, which he used to manufacture some of his large speculum mirrors. So to that extent, he did have some effect on the development of what Alan Chapman would call grand amateur astronomy in the Northwest.
In the realm of speculation, if he had built the giant 60-inch telescope, is it possible that we could have made some of the discoveries sooner or indeed made them from here in the Northwest?
Well, had he built that 60-inch telescope, who knows what he would have discovered with it. It probably wouldn't have performed as well as he thought. Tube currents were a problem with a smaller instrument. It was an iron tube, or it was going to be an iron tube reflector, which would have taken a long time to cool down. So apart from observing bright objects, such as the moon and planets, it's unlikely that he would ever have tried to observe, shall we say, deep sky objects, such as his friend Lord Rosse, and much before that, William Herschel were observing with their big reflecting telescopes. Naismith's telescope was never really suitable for observing faint objects. With three reflections in the optical train, it lost about 50 or 60% of the incoming light. As far as we are aware, deep sky observing, galaxies or nebulae as they were then called, didn't form part of his observing interest.
Kevin Kilburn from the Society of the History of Astronomy, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Another industrialist who found financial success in selling beer to the workers in and around Liverpool, a contemporary of Naismith, and being geographically so close they frequently communicated, Gerard Gilligan from Liverpool AS talks about William Lassell.
William Lassell, although associated with Liverpool, he wasn't actually born here.
No, he was born in Bolton in 1799. His father was a timber merchant, formed a partnership with James Gregson, and through that partnership he actually met his wife, Mary Gregson, who he married several years later. And then William came along, and of course William was the youngest of four members of the family. His father died in 1810, and the family actually moved back to Liverpool about 1815. He finished his education here, I think, and by 1822 he'd gone to an apprenticeship as a brewer. There are indications that the apprenticeship was with a cousin of his who had a wine merchant. But by about 1824 he was starting a business himself as a brewer.
So although his father may have been a carpenter, he made his money through beer.
Yes. But the other strange thing is, of course, that his great-grandfather and his grandfather were both clock and watchmakers, and William didn't really follow them into that kind of business. However, I think there's a clear indication that that might have been the avenue where he got his astronomical interest from. But in his early years, he was actually interested in many branches of sciences, but of course astronomy seemed to capture him more.
He was quite a gifted engineer.
He was indeed. He did, of course, tap into a great deal of expertise that was available to him at the time for building his telescopes and his mirror making. But he devised a lot of the mirror making machines himself, the ability to move a very heavy specular mirror telescope on its own, equatorian mounted. But if there was any expertise, he wasn't on shore. He was always asking for help. For example, there was, of course, Lord Rosse, who at the time was making very big specular mirror telescopes. They were confined in their movement, but still Lassell wanted to tap into expertise that Lord Rosse had in making large mirror telescopes. And, of course, he had a 40-year friendship with the famous Scottish engineer James Naismith, who, of course, had his factory in Manchester.
He had to make the tools to make the tools to allow him to observe.
Oh, yes. One of the things he wanted to do is he wanted to make large specular mirror telescopes. However, he wanted to try and repeat or reproduce the movement of the hand polishing mirrors, and to do it either via steam or a combination of steam and mechanical means. And Lord Rosse was doing that mainly with wooden-type machines, but Lassell thought they would get a better result by incorporating the same kind of machines, but using metal and steam-driven, so that mirrors could literally be left for hours on end without any human interference. Occasional checks, perhaps, but... And I think he devised two or three machines which he utilised for his entire career as an amateur astronomer.
So it was the first example of automation in mirror making?
Maybe.
How many and what size mirrors did he make?
He made three significant telescopes in his lifetime, a 9-inch, a 24-inch and a 48-inch. The 9 and the 24-inch were literally carbon copies of one another, except, of course, the 24-inch was a much scaled-up version of the 9-inch. The 9-inch, of course, proved itself very much, but he realised that if he could repeat it with a much larger mirror telescope to give it much better powers, much more better resolution and detail, then he tried to have a go. And so the blueprint for the 24-inch was already in existence. The drawback for him was he was living in an industrial growing city, maritime port, and at the time it wasn't, of course, light pollution, it was actually industrial pollution, and the weather in Northern England that was putting paid to a great deal of his astronomy. So he had the ingenious plan of moving his 24-inch telescope to Malta in the Mediterranean, which I think, without argument, had nearly 365 days of clear nights, and he was guaranteed to have long periods of clear nights, moonless clear nights, that he could do detailed observations of the objects he was interested in.
And did he take his 48-inch with him there?
The 48-inch followed. The 24-inch went to Malta between about 1851 to 53. The 24-inch was built on the outskirts of Liverpool in this third great residence of Liverpool, Bradstones, which was sited in West Derby, which is about 12 miles outside the city centre that we know today. 48-inch was built and tested in that location. However, its use was mainly in Malta, which he took. He took the 48-inch to Malta between 1861 and 65.
Now, moving something that size, 48-inch telescope, such a long way away, is an indication of his dedication to his hobby. And this was his hobby, wasn't it?
Well, if I can put it like this, I think it's been said before elsewhere by Alan Chapman of all people, it's the equivalent of an individual like ourselves interested in amateur astronomy funding, organising and setting their an observatory base up, the equivalent of the Hawaiian observatories doing the same sort of thing, but funding and planning the whole exercise by themselves. The manifest for the ship that took the 24-inch to Malta, which was the Cunard sailing ship, the SS Damascus, I think lists 260 packing cases, which was probably the stripped-down, packed-up 24-inch telescope, his chemistry lab, the workshop to give the telescope support, because he was able to take mirrors out of the telescope, repolish them if need be, and put them back in the telescope. And the packing list also includes a grand piano. So the household, including servants, his wife, his daughters, all went to Malta as well.
What discoveries did he make? What contribution to astronomy did he make with these observations?
His prime interest was, of course, the outer planets that we knew at the time, which is, of course, mainly Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. He's most famous, really, for discovering the chief moon of Neptune, Triton. And he discovered Triton in 1846, literally a matter of days after Neptune was first discovered.
Discovery of Triton. Did he make that from Liverpool?
Yes. He established himself in a villa, again, only about 2 miles outside the then city centre, at an observatory and residency called Starfield.
Mm-hmm.
And the 9-inch and the 24-inch had their own purpose-built observatories at the bottom of his garden.
Uh-huh.
And once the discovery of Triton was made known to the wider astronomical community, both professional as amateur, as they were at the time, most of those amateurs, like George Bidleri, Professor Otto Struve from the Russian Moscow Observatory, beat a hasty loan to his door at Starfield. And there's a great deal of correspondence and evidence within archives today that he entertained many, many people around a very large dining room table.
Right.
But unlike the Victorian tradition of the men going to a smoking room and the women going elsewhere, everybody was invited down to the garden to look through the telescopes.
The 24-inch, did that also have an observatory there at Starfield?
Yes, it did. Yes, the 9-inch and the 24-inch both had their own purpose-built observatory.
And when you go there today, what's left?
I'm afraid it doesn't exist at all now, the villa, I'm afraid. However, in the 1920s and 30s, there was actually a residential street called Starfield Street, which gave an indication of the location of the observatory and villa. However, it's now a school playground, St. Michael's School Playground.
And what of his telescopes? Did they survive?
The 9-inch, I'm afraid, not. I don't think any of that exists. The main components that still exist are from the 24-inch, which most of them are now housed in the museum here, collections. The finder of the 24-inch, I think two of the primary mirrors, and that great deal of the eyepieces that he used and made himself, and some of the prisms. And I understand that the only part of the 14th inch that still exists is a flat secondary mirror B, which is in the Whipple Museum of History of Science in Cambridge.
Now, you've written a lot about him. How did you go about doing your research?
My interest in William Lassell actually began by a lecture that was given to Liverpool Astronomical Society back in 1989 by Dr. Alan Chapman. The very first William Lassell Memorial Lecture that was incorporated into the Society's programme, the first speaker was Alan Chapman, and I managed to purloin a photograph of Lassell and did some initial research on him, and it galvanised the interest in Alan Chapman, who of course has this phenomenal interest in the history of amateur astronomy. Specifically, one of the interests is the Victorian Grand Amateurs, as he's called them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a launching point for a paper he did for the Vistas of Astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And once that research, which I helped him with, was finished, I actually carried on, because it coincided with myself researching my own family history, and I thought I would try and research Lassell's and see if any living descendants were still in existence. Because the main object of that was that we had no illustration or plans of the 24-inch telescope whatsoever. There wasn't any in any archives.
Mm-hmm.
Only the 9-inch, and of course it did help us that as I've said before, the 24-inch was a bigger version of the 9-inch in design and operation. But we didn't have any proper illustrations at all. A description, yes, but nothing else. So it was a sort of point to aim for to see if the living descendants had any additional information. After about a 5-year research that I did, I managed to trace descendants, and from that really the booklet came about as well.
Gerard Gilligan from Liverpool Astronomical Society, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Gabriel.
In November 1639, Venus transited the Sun. Its tiny shadow passed across the city of Salford. On June the 8th, 2004, it did it again. Only this time, thousands, perhaps millions of astronomers, amateur and professionals, were set to observe, record and enjoy it with the full force of the technology of the 21st century. The 1639 event, however, was witnessed for the first time in human history by only two people on the planet, about 25 miles from each other in the northwest of England: William Crabtree in Salford and Jeremiah Horrocks in Preston. Carl Barry and Lillian Fletcher, who now live a stone's throw from where Crabtree made his observation, researched Crabtree's life during the lead-up to the 2004 transit and documented their findings. Links to Carl and Lillian's document and a 19-meg MPEG video of my recording of the transit are available on this episode, episode 9, notes on www.astrotalkuk.org. Carl and Lillian, welcome to Astrotalk UK. Can I ask you, what got you interested in Crabtree in the first place?
Our main work was started because of the transit occurring in 2004. And little things that had bugged us earlier just got us going. I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could put his name somewhere in the area where he lived?
And, of course, the main reason why you're doing this is because you live pretty much close to the same spot that Crabtree did his work.
Very close. Oh, 400 or 500 yards maximum, yes. And I've known the area for many, many years.
How long have you lived in this area?
Since about 1939-40. And in this house since 1941.
Wow. Lillian, do you consider yourself as a local historian?
No, I don't think so, no. I've just got a bee in my bonnet. I want Crabtree to have his full due.
Right.
When we listened to the radio and television in 2004, it was all Horrocks. Yeah. And we give Horrocks his due, but as he was so dependent upon his friendship with Crabtree, I think we can show an awful lot of Horrocks's work that was linked to his contact with Crabtree, a letter.
And Crabtree's decimalisation, assisting observations to a much greater degree, and these were passed on to Horrocks.
After your research, were you able to put a cross on the map of the position where he did his observation?
Oh, yes. Yes, with Carl's material research, I feel that we have pinpointed the house. In fact, the remains of the actual house, we think, is still there. Altered, but still there.
And that's Ivy Cottage.
Ivy Cottage is has the oldest part.
Yes. Uh-huh. So how would you regard his profession? Was he a mathematician?
Well, was an amateur mathematician, but he was a professional businessman. He was a Chapman, interesting name, Chapman, in Manchester. He was a cloth merchant. Prof Chapman from Oxford believes this is what enabled him to have the money and time to indulge himself in his hobby to a considerable extent.
So he used his income and his mathematical prowess to calculate with higher accuracy the positions of the planets, the work that perhaps had been done by Tycho and Kepler.
Crabtree.
As well as calculating the fact that transit of Venus is likely to occur, he actually was able to observe it. What do you think was the more profound an achievement, observing it or calculating it?
Oh, that's a very interesting question.
The clever stuff is calculating.
Yes.
But for the world, it's the seeing of it. Mm. You know, people want proof. Otherwise, it's taking things on faith, which, you know, is open to question.
So
we saw an actual spot on in 2004. It brought tears to my eyes.
So when Crabtree saw this, as well as giving him validation of his mathematical approach, it also did something more profound. It somehow ensured that we were aware of that bigger picture. Our understanding of the universe was
revolutionised scientific thinking as to the solar-centric or earth-centric.
And he was quite fortunate because it was quite a cloudy day, as they tend to be in Lancashire.
Just in time, really. You know, just after 3 o'clock, when we know it in November, which is now December, mm-hmm. Well, 3 o'clock, things can get rather grim, and a grey day at that.
And he wasn't alone in this observation.
No, the Horrocks, of course, in Muchhool, observed it. He actually took observations. The story goes that Crabtree was so thrilled at the idea, and so almost dancing about with joy, one might say, that he forgot to take specific observations.
Well, I can understand that. It made me
weird. Yeah.
I think I'd have forgotten to put the markings on, but I think Horrocks' training at university must have come to him, his aid there. And without that, he might also have been, relegated a bit in history. Uh-huh. And those other two fellows, Gascoigne and Horrocks' brother, neither of them get a mention. And they were both observing.
Did they actually observe the transit?
They had their apparatus ready, right. Everything ready, but it just stayed grey.
On that, do you think if it had been cloudy for Horrocks and Crabtree, that somehow this unique contribution would have been lost in the fog of history?
Well,
I would imagine so, yes. After all, what is it, 112 years before it was likely to occur again? Someone would have discovered it, but 112 years later, no doubt.
And we are talking about a period in history which is about 20 years after Galileo used the telescope to look at the heavens. Here we are, in the northwest of England, two people, about 25 miles apart, seeing something that no human being had ever seen.
That is true.
Crabtree and Horrocks, did they ever meet?
No, sadly. They were due to meet, and Horrocks died at a tragically early age, or 21, 2, 3, only a matter of days prior to a planned meeting. He was due to come down to Broughton from Muchhool.
Pity, we'll never know what other discoveries he would have.
Very, very sad. Gascoigne was killed at the Battle of Marston Moor. Crabtree died in 1644.
Question mark.
1653, yes. Horrocks died in 1641, something like that.
He died very soon after the observation, really, didn't he?
That's right, very young age.
Yes.
Look, finally, you know, we were all fortunate to be here to see in June 2004 repetition of the transit of Venus. And of course, one of the things that Crabtree discovered is that they happen in pairs, 8 years apart. So the next one's due in 2012. That sadly won't be visible from here. Do you plan to travel to see it again?
8 years' time, we're 84.
Are you?
Yes, we're 92. Can you imagine?
No reason why I want to come with you.
We would love it.
I'd love to see it again, but there's no chance.
Well, I don't know. There's every chance. Carl and Lillian, I'm really grateful for your time today and sharing your adventures with this extremely important and interesting story and all the time and effort you put in there. Thank you very much indeed.
It's our pleasure. We've enjoyed it thoroughly.
Thank you for listening to AstroTalk UK. ATUK is a non-profit project produced and recorded by Gurbir Singh. He nor any of the participants are paid for their contribution. ATUK's content is not validated against any authoritative source, and all the views and opinions are held by those who choose to express them. If you have a topic of interest you would like to discuss on ATUK, drop me a note, info@astrotalkuk.org.